Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented to you by Cooper Tires and our friends at the Justice Brothers. We have an episode of Catching Up With. This time it's with our old pal, Will Buxton, who's coming off of three consecutive days of speaking into a microphone, covering the very first group test, Formula One in Europe. And so we caught Will at the end of the day today, knowing that his voice was almost shot and he was pretty much out on his feet, having worn himself out trying to bring us great digital coverage of what was taking place. Speaking with Will about the debut, finally, of his brand new book, My Greatest Defeat. This is something that we've spoken with Will about previously on the podcast, and back when it was just an idea, was trying to do my best to help Will with contacts or otherwise, whatever it might be, to help a friend and also a fellow journalist to get his first book in print. So having taken part in three or four books myself, co-author, never actually done a full book on my own, just makes me so happy to see a friend put together something that I know from some of the excerpts is just phenomenal. So catching up with Will started off with his book. He also brings one of the passages to life, a little bit of audiobook with Will Buxton, with our dear friend Alex Zanardi. Brings some of those passages to life. Really, really captivating stuff from The Pineapple. And then we move into some of Will's observations about testing, everything from Ferrari being quick like a bunny to a little bit of the Williams saga of them being behind yet again, and general thoughts, a couple questions we also got in on Twitter that we close with posed to Will. So about a half hour or so, that's our format for catching up with. Nothing too long, just trying to bring you a little snapshot, and having just ordered his brand new book on Amazon, cannot wait for that to arrive here in the coming months. All right, let's get going with our man Will Buxton. Catching Up With, brought to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers.
It's been a pretty busy winter, mate. It really has. It's lovely to be back on the podcast. Thanks for inviting me on. I massively appreciate it.
So we'll get to we had some questions that came in for you that are great about the 22 hours of preseason commentary and testing you've just helped provide. But My Greatest Defeat, I'm so happy that this is now something we can speak about as a finished product, something that I was able to just click the good old pre-order button on through Amazon. This just went up for sale yesterday, I believe, and
yes. It's
pretty darn cool seeing that Amazon is ranking it number one in automotive history, number four in motorsports, and number 11 in transportation history. So good job, man. It's not even available, and you're hitting some good numbers.
It's crazy. That's all come out of, like, one tweet or something. We haven't even started the book tour or the proper promotional tour because it's not out in until May, I don't think, in the UK. And I think it comes out June, July time in the States, which is, I can't believe that it's coming out. I'm so happy. It's coming out on Evro. Who published David Hobb's book. So that's lovely to be in the same stable as my old pal, Hobbo, which is amazing. And writers like David Tremaine, who has played such an important role in my career and my life, have my name alongside those kind of writers and those kind of people is a huge honor for me. And it's lovely. It's been a great process working with the guys, working with Giuseppe Camenco, the artist who pens for Marvel Comics, Darth Vader, and Spider-Man. So he's done all of the artwork for the book. It looks lovely. I think it reads great. And there's just some beautiful stories in there. And as I think, we discussed from the outset, the idea of the book came about kind of by mistake, because I wanted to know of a driver's lowest moment and, the race where it was all taken away from them. And actually, it became something far bigger and far deeper, and it actually just became the lowest human moment that all of these racing greats had experienced. And so many of the stories ended up not being about racing, but just about the human spirit and how easy it is to get that beaten down. And I learned so much about the drivers in researching this book, but I learned in turn a huge amount about myself. And at a time when, we're being told that it's okay to be fragile and to admit when we're not doing so good, to hear from Dario Franchitti and, Mario Andretti and Alex Zanardi and Bobby Unser and Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson and all these great racers that they have had moments in their life where they've looked themselves in the mirror and said, shit, what do I do? What do I do next? That they all struggle every bit as much as you and I. But when they pull that helmet on, they just can't think about it. And they have to get on with the job of being a race car driver. And it's been an amazing journey. It is an incredible journey. And so to see these 20 stories, see each of the drivers read back their words and come back to me and say, yeah, I stand by that. And I will give you the right to publish those words, my words, my stories, has been it's been a lovely thing.
So the reason, among the many reasons why I was so happy to hear that you were doing this, and now that we can actually speak about a finished product, and I'll ask you to pick a few of the subjects you've mentioned, or maybe some you haven't, and just share basically a brief audiobook with Will Buxton here, since we are, you know, a couple months away from this being something that'll be in folks' hands. But I've loved this premise all along. I think I mentioned it on the last podcast that we did, Will, because it is so easy for what you and I do as reporters and journos and whatnot to go up to driver X and say, hey, tell me about something cool and great and positive. And those stories are awesome. They fill your heart and all kinds of things where you just hear birds singing and then the sun just radiating over all of us in a lovely, lovely glow. It's half the story, half a picture of what makes us human, and where this drew me in, this topic, when you mentioned it a few years back, it was the, aha, I actually, it's funny, man, I mean, I turned 48 in December, maybe it's just an age thing, I think, Will, I'm getting close to my limit for super inspirational stories, and I don't want to say that I'm turning cranky, it just means you live long enough, you've heard enough of them. I don't know how much I can take out of the person who overcame amazing odds, physical odds, mental odds, whatever it is, and triumphed and won that thing. Those are great. If you're newish to the world, those things can mean a lot to inspire you. At least as I'm getting older, as 50 isn't too far away, the things I'm more drawn to happens to be the premise that you cover here with your subjects of, tell me about the bad things. Tell me about the things that really weren't hard, that really weren't easy, that were really hard, and how you worked your way out of them, or what you found in those moments, because that, to me, at least in my life experience, is becoming the area where you go, huh, all right, and as I'm getting older, maybe the challenges are where I need to find knowledge and maybe inspiration instead of the just big, happy, smiley, shiny things that we can all applaud.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, we look at these guys and we aspire to them and what they can do and the immense talent that they have, but they're still human beings. And, you know, beyond the heroics and the helmets and the fire suits, they're just people, you know? And it became very clear very quickly that they did struggle, and that it was only kind of after leaving racing that they can kind of look back on it and start to deal with it. And that, you know, if we're looking for moments in our life where we need some inspiration, we need some help, then to see that the people that we aspire towards also struggle and also need help or needed help, that maybe we can look at that. And the purpose of the book is not for me to tell you what to think. Each of the chapters is a very raw interview with each driver. And so my hope was to invite the reader to sit down at the table with us, to pull up a chair, grab a drink, sit down, and to be part of the conversation, so that everybody that reads the book takes a different lesson out of it. I'm not going to tell you what to think about what Dario's telling you, or what Derek Bell's telling you, or Emanuele Pirro, or whoever. I want you to read their words, listen to their story, and take your own lessons from it. And some of them you won't find anything in common with, and you'll be like, yeah, okay, whatever. But I hope that somewhere in the book, everybody that reads it will find something that resonates with them, something that allows them to look back on something in their own life and go, oh my God, okay, that makes a lot of sense now. And or look at it and think, oh, I'd never thought about that, and that allows me to understand a part of myself I've not unlocked. And that's my hope. Or maybe I'm building it up to be far more than it actually is. But I, in getting there, in doing these interviews, so say I, it really helped me understand a lot about myself. And I hope that does the same for other people.
Why don't you do us the honor of picking someone for us to start off with, and whether it's a passage or a story in total or whatever it might be, why don't you start us off with...
What would you like? Would you like an overarching story of somebody's story, or would you like an actual passage? Because obviously it's their words, so I can't do very good impressions. Like, I can do a Nicky Lauda impression, yeah? But I can't do it very well.
I think it's
actually amazing.
Nicky is one that you've mentioned to me before in private, that it really, that was really a powerful one for you. So, yeah, I'd say actually if you can just pick a page or two, or whatever it might be, let's actually read some from the book.
Well,
since
I tell you what, I was going through, and actually, I mean, look, let me give you something from Alex, because it's close to the start of the book, and it's 320 pages. So I'm going through, and I found there's this one quote from Alex that I really love, from Alex
Zanardi.
And we all know Alex and how wonderful he is. But Alex's story, quite incredibly, is not about him losing his legs. Alex's story is based around his decision to leave Champ Car, IndyCar, and go back to Formula One, and to give up all that he'd created and everything he was doing in the States, and to go back to Formula One, and the fact that that didn't work for him, and ultimately led down the path that put him in a position where he was in the race that he lost his legs, and in the car that he was in, and all of those things. And I was asking him, why didn't you tell the people at Williams that things were going as wrong as they were? Because he said he felt he couldn't tell anybody what was going on, and he felt so completely stifled by the situation. And he said that I was a human being. I couldn't. If I went back in time, I'd know what to do. And so I ask him the question. I say, look, I think a lot of people would find it difficult to understand that Alex Zanardi, this great champion and a guy who we know today has the heart of a lion and can do anything, that he would be too timid and not have the confidence to tell his truth. So how did the situation get so bad that it became impossible for you to be able to tell people these things? And this was his response. Well, first of all, we could live 1,000 lives and still die as ignorant people. 1,000 lives wouldn't be sufficient to learn everything we can possibly learn. But in comparison, from when I was in my late 20s or early 30s, today I'm in my 50s and I'm a completely different person. Today I'm not as well equipped as far as my muscles' capability to deliver energy, but I'm incredibly more equipped from the standpoint of my mental strength and the capability of knowing not necessarily how to deliver something magical, but how to deliver absolutely everything I can. It's as simple as that. Because sometimes you're much better than the others simply because you're approaching your 100% and they're only delivering 25% of what they could. Take the Ironman. It's a perfect example of a discipline where your mental strength is incredibly important. And knowing what you have to do, which is everything that you can, will lead to the equivalency between your potential and the performance that you deliver. If you start the race and you're in your 20s and you think, okay, roughly my potential is to finish the race in 12 hours, but you start the race and you go after a guy who has a 10-hour potential, then for the first 4 hours, you'll stick with him, thinking, shit, I thought this was going to be much tougher than this. This is a piece of cake. It's a Sunday afternoon ride.
Mm.
But then when you crash, you make a noise that everyone will hear from the finish line, and you'll still have 120 kilometers in front of you between the cycling and the running, which is 42 kilometers on his own. So the result is not only do you fall away from the guy who's doing his race, but you can't even finish your own. Your target is gone, and the rest of it is not only torture, but it's torture that will last another 6 or 7 hours. So it's not that today I'm stronger. It's that I know what my value is. I know what I'm capable of. I get decent results in things that I do because I'm smart enough to say yes or no. So I do this, and because I do it to the best of my ability, because I do it well, actually, this stupid thing that I do will provide me with a bit of exposure and a love and an affection from people watching that's superior to the one that I'd get if I did something which from the word go seems more popular. The reality is that if you don't do something well, it won't grant you anything other than a bitter sensation because you won't even enjoy yourself when you're doing it.
Wow. And did you then say, and so back to my original question, why isn't that you... But that is the beautiful flowery path painted by Alex Zanardi when asked a question like that, is you're not going to receive a yes, no, or a four-word sentence that succinctly answers the question. You're going to receive some sort of parable or otherwise that asks you to think, possibly in abstract, or to connect the strands on your own. But yeah, what a wonderful human being.
Yeah, he really is. He really is.
Were there any others in the book that might come to mind, Will, where for you, maybe you didn't know them. It might have been a first-time meeting for you, or first-time serious interview with them, where there might be a passage that came where, while sitting there with someone you didn't know, didn't have that familiarity that often helps in situations like this, some sort of shorthand to draw from to get great stories and quotes from, where you were sitting there going, holy cow, this human being, we're effectively strangers, and yet here's something that they're giving that is just
okay, so personal. Yeah. So Jeff Gordon, who I'd met maybe... Actually, it was really crazy. So I was at the Singapore Grand Prix, and I'd emailed you and said, yo, Marshall, have you got a contact for Jeff? I'm writing a book. I really need to contact him. I think he'd be perfect for it. I'd love to talk to him. And I'd sent that, and no more than 30 minutes later, I'm walking through the Singapore Grand Prix paddock, and I get this bump on my back, and I turn around, and it's Jeff Gordon, and he's like, hey, Will, I really wanted to meet you. I watched your stuff on NBC, and I was like, are you kidding? I really want to meet you. This is so awesome. And I said, did Marshall... And he was just like, no. And I was just like, oh, okay, this is really weird. So I explained the concept of the book, and he said, I have to be in it. I was like, okay, cool. And it wasn't until the next year... it was a couple of weeks, a couple of months later, we were in Mexico for the Mexican Grand Prix. And we sat down and we did the interview. And it got to the end, and we were both, like, in tears and giving each other a hug. And he said, why was that so emotional for you? I said, dude, with the exception of the four NASCAR titles, we've had, like, the same life.
Wow.
And it just, because there was a part of it where he was talking to me and I was finishing his sentence. And then I'd say because of this. And he'd go, yeah, but then this. And I'd go, precisely, but then that only happens because of this. And he's like, no, totally, and then this. So that was a real moment for me of somebody that I didn't know, that I didn't have a personal relationship with, that I came out of the room and I was like, my God, we could, like, literally, our stories are so closely aligned. And what we learned from that was so big. That was amazing. But, you know, I love Bobby Unser's story. That was amazing, too. Somebody that I'd never met, and I still have never met in person. But we had this amazing... I mean, you know what Uncle Bobby's like. Yeah. But we just had this thing. We just clicked over the phone. And again, like this... Just this amazing guy talking as if he's recollecting something that happened 2 days ago. And again, just in pieces, just in floods of tears, crying about this moment of his life where it all came unstuck.
And it being Uncle Bobby, I'm hoping you told the proofreaders, yeah, go a little easy on the Unser one. Bobby is the author... He's the screenwriter and director and editor of his life's movie. And it is at times documentary. It is at times a wonderful work of fiction. But if you don't look too close, then you just enjoy it. There are a few human beings on the planet Earth that are just better at being themselves and sharing themselves than Uncle Bobby. So...
I mean, that was the wonderful thing with all of these chapters, and you say, you know, with the editors and everything, is, you know, I transcribed these interviews very much as they were conducted. So the grammar, the punctuation is imperfect. There are words in there that aren't real words. They're just, you know, when somebody whose first language isn't English sometimes says something, you know what they mean. And actually that makes it more human because it's what they've said. So everything that's written is imperfect. The way that you read it in each chapter will be different because the sentence structure is imperfect, because it's the way that each person has actually speaks. Because my hope is that you hear their voice when you read it. I want you to be at that table. I want you to hear their voice. So the editing job, and the guys have been absolutely fantastic with it because they understood the notion and the concept from the outset. They haven't changed really anything in the way that I've written it, just a couple of spelling mistakes I've made here and there, but in terms of the punctuation, the grammar, it remains imperfect because human beings don't speak perfectly. So you hopefully hear everybody's voice as you read their words, and that was a part, again, for me, of making the human connection through the pages of a book to the reader and to the subject matter of each chapter.
Well, speaking of imperfect, one of the things that I enjoyed while pulling up the book and ordering it on Amazon were some of the sponsored products related to this item.
Seriously.
I mean, again, we don't know exactly who formulates the algorithms. We're hoping that Skynet is not becoming self-aware as a result of your book hitting Amazon. But for those who might buy My Greatest Defeat, just know that at least in the U.S., if you scroll down, Amazon suggesting wrestling writing, capturing the people and culture of the greatest sport on earth. We have one that, again...
Incidentally, Bret the Hitman Hart's autobiography remains one of the best books I've ever read.
Yet another reason I love you. We have Tor in The Dark Art of Anonymity. Clearly your book fits some categories, but Amazon also thinks that it fits in among some other rather, we'll call them diverse offerings, so good on you.
Okay.
Well, again, this is, at least in the U.S., says it will be available for shipping on July 30th, so I can't wait to get that.
Right.
As I try and mention to folks, hopefully you might have heard, doing my best to have as many interviews as possible with those who are doing, whether it's new automotive, auto racing, documentaries, who are writing new books, and in every case I purchase those books or whatever else because although they are often offered as free copies, this is an art form that at least I'm a big believer that we need to support it in the only way that Will Buxton gets to write a second book and a third and others get to write more is by purchasing them and giving publishers like Evro and Coastal 181 and just so many other really great houses a reason to put more books on the motor racing books on the shelves.
I appreciate that, man.
Let's move to our last topic here, that being your fairly insane, your own marathon of speaking into a microphone. Looking at the combined times over a couple of days there in testing. Interesting,
yeah.
For sure. Nico Hülkenberg sitting atop the combined overall list from February 18th through today. And then looking at some of the other performances, at least in this initial outing, what comes to mind from various things you've observed that pique your interest or surprise you?
Well, you know that you can't read anything into pre-season training. So I think, like, you got to go on body language, how the drivers look, how the cars look on track. I think that Ferrari have got it.
Mm.
I think they've absolutely got it. The car looks sensational. It looks bulletproof. It looks quick. The team have an air of joy and confidence about them. Vettel is literally floating across the paddock. Leclerc already just fits in perfectly. So I think Ferrari have got a little march on the field already at the start of the season. Mercedes are already very mindful of that. Talk amongst the paddock is that it could be anywhere from 0.5 seconds, the gap between Ferrari and Mercedes already. So
wow.
It looks like Ferrari have done something pretty good, but nobody's turned their engine up to the max yet. But fuel corrected and all that kind of stuff. There's reason to believe that Ferrari have done a pretty stellar job. You know, Mercedes are not going to be a million miles behind, and as we've seen over the last two seasons, they have outraced, outthought, outdeveloped Ferrari. But in this new way at Ferrari, without Arrigo Benetti at the helm of the team, may Ferrari have the calm approach to be able to match that development, match that pace, and keep the fight with Mercedes going to the end of the season? I think that's what everyone wants to see. The big question is, has Honda developed something that will allow Red Bull to compete for wins and podiums? And honestly, the Honda in the back of the Toro Rosso and the Red Bull looked dead on, man. It looked bulletproof, it looked quick, and you can't say we've been able to say that about a Formula One Honda engine for some time. So, yeah, that's looking good. I think the really interesting one for me is Alfa Romeo. The team we used to know as Sauber, now Alfa Romeo, they went to work a long time ago on this year's car and came up with a completely new, completely different front wing concept that's different to what anyone else has done. Essentially, they've only got front wing elements in the middle of the wing, and there's then a large gap, about a 3-inch gap, to the front wing end plate. No one else has done that. No one else is even close to doing that. So if they've got that right, it's not as simple as everyone else just copying it and putting it on their car, because of course everything behind the front wing is influenced in its design by what the front wing is doing. So it's an almost total redesign job for everybody to make that work if it proves to be the silver bullet. So while I don't think it's going to be a Braun GP 2009, oh my God, we're going to get to Australia and Alfa Romeo is going to be first and second, I think they could shock and they could surprise, and they could certainly be at the front of the midfield, if not knocking on the door for a podium if things don't quite go the right way for some of the top teams. So, yeah, a lot to be excited about. Big headlines about the fact that Williams didn't make it there until the third day of the test.
And what was that, Will? I mean, was that something storm in a teacup, or was that deserved of the amount of vitriol that I've seen written about it due to the we're going to get our act together this year and then the disregard that type sentiment?
I mean, look, it's you know, last year was Paddy Lowe's first car at the team, and it was a dog. Whether it was a correlation issue between wind tunnel, CFD, what they saw on track, it never improved throughout the year. So this was the year when he was supposed to come up with the goods and create something that would help the team back on a path to righteous success, and the car wasn't ready. So I think Paddy's massively under the microscope right now. But let's be realistic here. Over recent years, the likes of Force India or Sauber have started testing off with a year-old car and have brought their new car to the second week of testing, sometimes not even until we got to Australia. So the fact that Williams have a car, even if it only appeared on the third day of the first week of testing, is still a good thing for them, because they're getting it, they're running it through its paces. I think, though, that the difference between that and what went before is that the Sauber and the Force Indias of the world never had an intention of bringing a new car to those tests. They had a run plan based around their old car and a pre-season based around that notion that they wouldn't have their new car until later. This isn't the case at Williams. It's a screw-up. And at a time when the team is already under the microscope, it's something they didn't need.
Let me ask one more question, Will, before we grab a couple of the questions and then let you get some well-deserved rest. So the new Ferrari was obviously being conceptualized, and design work would have started quite some time ago before team principal Mr. Arrivabene was parted with. Means that the byproduct of what we've seen so far in testing definitely came to life while he was still part of the organization. But I realize that at this stage of the season, folks are just wanting to look at lap times and lap numbers, and it's more of a technical conversation. But curious if you can share any thoughts on just the feel side and what you might have observed in the Ferrari, the Scuderia Ferrari garages, that might have been a little bit different. And again, I know that it's not something we can quantify many other aspects, but you and I both know, everyone feeling under the gun, you might not get the best at all times.
Yeah, it's, look, I mean, the thing here is that Mattia Binotto obviously was in charge of the design side and the technical side of the team, and he's now team boss. So he's always had a handle on that side of the team. And although, as we understand it, certainly the vibe at the team was one of, you know, rule by fear by Maurizio Riva-Bene, but I don't think he was, you know, sort of foaming at the mouth in the design office every day, growling at his designers to design him a better car. I don't think we can go that far.
If only you'd ask. You'd never asked that before. Now we will.
I know. That's why they never had a webcam in the design offices. They just didn't want everybody to see. It's Binotto is a very calm, very cool customer, and I think that is starting to play out on the team. I think one thing we've seen is, you know, we never saw them lose their pride in wearing that red shirt, but I think they lost an element of the joy in that. And it was something that Toto Wolff said last year around Spa, was that the team needed to remember to have fun and have joy in what it was doing all the way through. That was very important. And I think we've seen an element of that come back to the team this week. You know, everybody has a smile on their face. There's a levity at the team. They're taking, obviously, everything very, very seriously. But it's little things like, I don't know, like, the, you know, 10, 15 minutes before the end of the session, the guys are out the back of the garage, you know, having a smoke. Little things like that. You know, there's just a little bit of levity. There's a little bit of ease there, that it's not all, oh God, you know, it's not all high pressure. They're enjoying themselves. They're calm, they're cool, they're confident. And that's the thing. They've had the better car, I think, at the start of the last two seasons, but they never had that belief, that confidence that they could take it. And, you know, inject a bit of that confidence, inject a bit of the cool calmness to it, and you know, Seb walking on air, and I think it'll be all right. I think it'll be good. Certainly from the initial impressions, it just feels like a bit of a happier place.
I love the idea of a 2019 Formula One season where McLaren is possibly back into the fight instead of the wah 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 story round after round. I love the idea of Mercedes being the one on the back foot and having to mastermind the fight back. Potentially, again, we're not making any claims, but the specter of that is something that makes me smile as well, going, ooh, okay, the script's gotten a little predictable the last, you know, during this new small displacement turbo formula era. I wouldn't mind changing that up a little bit, so.
No, totally.
Will, we have two questions here that really stand out. I'll save my favorite one for last. Of the two main ones that came in, I thought would be good for you with the limited time we have. Let's go to Nabil Zuhir, who says, hey, Will, quick question. I've always wondered whether it'd be plausible for Mercedes and Red Bull to move from the UK, in case of a no-deal Brexit, to Germany and Austria. Mercedes already has factories and facilities in Germany, for example. This is a topic that's been looming large and starting to get written about more and more. Where do you think Brexit might factor into Formula One stateship among certain teams based in the UK, since most are?
It's difficult to talk about Brexit and not be sort of accused of mixing politics and sport, and I know I haven't shied away from that on social media, because I feel quite strongly about it, and that it is sort of an act of national self-harm that really shouldn't be happening. But look, to deal with it in a non-political way, to look at it just simply on what could happen in the case of a no-deal Brexit, and I know it's quite a confusing concept. What is Brexit? What's going to happen? And honestly, even we as Brits don't know fully what is going to happen to our country in a month and a bit's time. Our ability to still trade freely, to move freely, and that is the worry right now, is, you know, we are an island nation and we rely on import and export. From a Formula One perspective, the team's based in the UK. In fact, from a motorsport basis, the teams, the suppliers based within the UK, rely on ease of trade, free trade, single market trade with Europe. If we leave the European Union on March the 29th with a no-deal Brexit, that means there are no customs arrangements, no trade agreements with our closest partners, with France, with shipping things to anywhere on the European continent. So it's a mystery as to what happens. But what we do know and what we are being prepared for are 30-mile tailbacks down the M23 to get to Calais to put things onto ships. We are dealing with we've been told food trucks will not be able to get into the country and food will be sitting there going rotten. Medicines are being stockpiled so that hospitals don't run out of medicines. You know, these are essentials for life, not pieces of racing car to go to another country. If we're at the Spanish Grand Prix, will Red Bull be able to ship out the wings that it needs on the constant updates throughout that weekend? Or are we going to be looking at a two-week backlog on shipping things out of the country? And that's the fear. And I think it's a well-founded fear because it could very easily be the reality. And if that becomes the reality, will a European-founded enterprise that has its basis in the UK be there by season's end? And by that, you're looking at Renault, Red Bull Racing, Mercedes, Toro Rosso has a base in Bicester, Haas obviously has big links with Italy. Why would you stay in the UK if imports and exports become not only more expensive but also take longer to the point of potentially crippling your business? And that is the fear for the whole of British motorsport, both as a supply and demand chain. It's a really worrying time.
You know, the one thing that I think of, and it's maybe an abstract thing, but just because I've known the company for a long time, Pankl, for example, in Austria, it's all super top secret, locked down, and, you know, the most bank vaultiest of bank vault type scenarios, but Pankl, as a supplier to the vast majority of Formula One teams and other racing teams, but you think about whether it's a drive shaft, it might be a piston to a one of the engine manufacturers in Formula One, something in the drive line. They are one of the go-to sources, and they are so good at what they do. There's some basics involved here. Hey, if the piece that we need to make the car go forward on a motor racing circuit or an engine and its reciprocating parts to combust and work or otherwise, if some of those things, and I'm just using one company, but if getting those things into the country is a challenge.
Essentially, mate, it's you know, for your listeners who might not understand sort of the gravity of it, it's kind of similar to North Carolina deciding to secede from the Union. And all of the NASCAR teams based within North Carolina suddenly not being part of what they had been and having to pay a massive tax levy on everything coming in and out, not being able to freely transport their equipment outside of the state or bring in parts to the state without massive tax burdens and massive delays. That's essentially where we're at. So it's a real worry.
And on that happy note, boys and girls, why don't we go ahead and close with a question from Patrick Stork. Definite softball, but I love softballs because sometimes you get unexpected answers. Patrick asks, who is the most impressive person you have met in Formula One or motorsports in general, Will?
Marshall Pruitt, obviously.
Oh, don't start with that nonsense.
Mate, you know what? It's so tough because I'm looking at nearly 20 years now of doing this and there are some amazing people that I've met over that time, you know, particularly writing this book. I've been honored to meet some amazing people who are inspirational figures, you know, like an Alex Zanardi, Mario Andretti, you know, total, absolute, you know, heroes of world sports, you know. And I look at people like Alex, like Robert Wickens or Billy Munger, who are coming through terrible moments in their life but show incredible resilience and inspiration and still joy in everything that they do despite having these things thrust upon them that you wouldn't wish on anybody, let alone people who are so genuinely decent, brilliant people. I've been really lucky to meet some amazing people doing this. I wouldn't like to single out just one, really. You know, I've met some amazing made some amazing friends. I've met the mother of my child. I've met the woman I'm going to marry and, you know, spend the rest of my life with. It's not been bad, has it?
Well, I am happy to be the baseline at the bottom. So at least you've listed a lot of others who are darn impressive. And the reality is, as you rightly mentioned, we do meet a lot of people. It's interesting how many folks who tell me they know me, often when there's a disagreement of some sort. Hey, you and I have met before. Why are you saying this or disagreeing with me so vehemently? And I'll say to them, do we know each other? Or did we shake hands and exchange pleasantries, but you probably couldn't tell me my middle name or my wife's name or where I was born? Big difference between I've met a lot of people and I know a lot of people. And so for me, and I think some of the folks that you've mentioned, the folks in our sport, our world, that I prize the relationships the most are the ones where you say, A, I'm so thankful for that other person's bad judgment for continually willing to engage with me and possibly to become a friend, but also to say, I actually know this person. I know their family. We truly connect as more than just professional colleagues who are duty-bound to interact for some reason. But, wow, this person, this name, this person who might be famous for their achievements as a sportsman or a sportswoman, actually knowing them and them knowing me, that thing somehow has made me better as a human being. So those are the things that I just constantly wake up in amazement, brother, that,
yeah,
like, holy cow, those are the things that I get. And so maybe this is a looping back to close the circle, but it's part of what I'm hoping folks are going to enjoy when they hopefully pick up My Greatest Defeat, is to say, maybe I don't know this person in real life, but good Lord, through this book, I feel like when I do get to meet Emerson Fittipaldi, Jimmy Johnson, Felipe Massa, Rick Mears, I feel like I am at least being introduced to an old friend. So, good on you, mate.
Thank you, man. Thank you. I appreciate that very much, my friend.
Go to sleep, Will Buxton. No more speaking into recording devices or on television for a little bit for you. Get some rest. Congratulations on this, and I'll look forward to speaking soon.
Thank you for your support and your friendship, as always, mate. I appreciate it.
And that was our pal, Will Buxton. Also wanted to say thank you to you for all the great support of late. In particular, traffic has really been at an all-time high. Also have some fun stuff coming here with some new 2019-themed Marshall Pruitt podcast gear that will be available on torontomotorsports.com. Revised all of the logos for my Week in IndyCar show, Week in Sports Car show. Have a brand new one for our brand new Inside the Sports Car Paddock show. And also going to have the brand new, somewhat new Hamburger and French Fry show. T-shirts and hats and whatnot made. The little videos that Sebastian Bourdais and I happen to do whenever we are together for an IndyCar race or sports cars and whatnot. So just trying to bring a little bit of fun to the paddock. And the great thing about all of those products on torontomotorsports.com is a good portion of the proceeds go to the Wilson Children's Fund to benefit the children of my late and dear friend, Justin Wilson. So buy some stuff and help Jane, Jess, and Julia. So all good stuff there. We're also a little over a week away from the launch of MarshallPruittPodcast.com. So you might be asking, hey, idiot, isn't your podcast kind of almost 3 years old now and you haven't had a dedicated website for it? Well, yeah, thankfully you take pity on me and you allow me the grace to take longer than I should to create such things. But that'll be up here live in just about a week, where every podcast from episode one with Mario Andretti to the latest here, I think this is going to be 486, they will all be there on the new MarshallPruittPodcast.com site and broken into specific categories as well. If you want to go exploring various themes, various shows, etc. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is a Marshall Pruitt podcast brought to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers. Thank you for listening.